Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Do Good to Lead Well webinar and podcast series. I'm your host, Craig Dowden, and I've been extremely excited about having this conversation for quite some time. This is definitely a highlight for me in 2024 thus far in terms of the episodes that we've had. And because of your ongoing support, the Do Good to Lead Well podcast is now rated in the top 0.5% of podcasts globally, according to Listen Notes. So really appreciate your support, your social shares, your comments, your feedback. And one of the main reasons, the primary reason why this podcast has garnered such a following and an enthusiastic community is some of the amazing guests that kindly contribute their time, their expertise, and their insight. And as I mentioned, I've been looking forward to speaking with Ethan for a very long time. You can see the book over my left shoulder to the right of the screen, Chatter. I'd almost ask people to put in the page number. And if I open the book, you'll see it's highlighted throughout. So I'm going to share a little bit of a bio, could not get into all of the details. But Ethan Cross is one of the world's leading experts on controlling the conscious mind, an award-winning professor in the University of Michigan's top-rated psychology department and its Ross School of Business. He is the director of the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory. He has participated in policy discussion at the White House and has been interviewed on CBS Evening News, Good Morning America, and NPR's Morning Edition. His pioneering research has been featured in the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, The New England Journal of Medicine, and Science. And I really wanted to share this endorsement that the book received because I just think it so beautifully captures what Chatter is all about. And this is from New York Times bestselling author and Wharton professor Adam Grant, who says, "This book is going to fundamentally change some of the most important conversations in your life, the ones you have with yourself." And I could not agree more. I loved every page in this book, Ethan, so a very warm welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well universe.
Oh, it's so kind of you, Craig. Just a total delight to be here. And that means a great deal coming from you as a colleague in this space. So let's get into it.
And again, Ethan has kindly agreed to take questions from the live audience. So one of the benefits of tuning in live this afternoon, you get to ask questions to one of the top thought leaders in the world. So please engage as you so often do. I would love to start the conversation, though, around, so what was the genesis, the origin story for the book Chatter? I thought it was fascinating.
You're talking about the bat, I think, the baseball
yes,
bat.
Yes, yes, right? Yeah. Okay.
There are a couple of stories that could fit that genesis theme. You know, the title of the book is Chatter, and I use that term to refer to getting stuck in a negative thought loop, right? So if it's a negative thought loop about the past, we tend to call that rumination. If it's about the future, that's worry. And one of the points I really wanted to impress upon readers is that if you experience chatter, welcome to the human condition. I have yet to meet an individual who is not at some point in time. And that is true even among people who are experts in studying this phenomenon and how to manage it. Now, yes, there are absolutely lots of things you can do to reduce the frequency and intensity of chatter. And I have benefited from those enormously in my own life. But do I experience chatter at times? Sure. And so I start the book with a story that tells the story of the most powerful time I had that experience in my life. It just started as an assistant professor here at the University of Michigan. And one of the studies that we had published ended up going viral. It was totally unpredictable, but it was really exciting when it happened. This was in the early 2010s. We had published a study showing that the experience of social pain, so being rejected by another human being, what we showed in this study is that that experience is akin to the experience of physical pain. So when people use the language, oh, my feelings are hurt, I'm in pain after being rejected, our findings, we use some neuroscience tools, demonstrated that we may be using that language, it may be more than a metaphor. When we use the language of physical pain to describe how we feel after being dumped, we may actually be referring to physical sensations that we're experiencing. And so this study caught a lot of attention, went on TV, it was super exciting. First time in my life, my mother was proud about my career choice, stopped trying to convince me to change professions, and life was good. And then about a week later, after the study had gotten all this attention, I come into my office at work and I go to check the mailbox. Back then, I guess I never checked the mailbox anymore, but 15 years ago I did. And there's a physical letter and it's hand addressed to me. And I, oh, how interesting. And, you know, I open it up, and the moment I open up the letter, I immediately experienced a kind of physiological symptoms of a kind of panic, fight or flight response, because what I saw in that letter was truly frightening. It was, you know, very threatening piece of literature that someone had directed towards me. There was identifying information, racial slurs, all sorts of very ugly stuff. First thing I did with it is I showed it to my assistant just to get a like perspective check. Am I making too big of a deal out of this? And the first thing she said was like, oh, you need to go report this to the police. And so a couple of hours later, I'm in the local police station getting interviewed by an officer who also looks at the letter, you know, shakes his head in dismay, and then says something to the effect of, yeah, that's not good. It happens every now and then. You know, not much we can do. You might as well just make sure to drive home a different way from work each day. Now, the irony of that, Craig, is that I live about 6 blocks from my office. So if you want to map out the different permutations on how I can get home, it's like there aren't too many ways of doing it. So this just sent me into a total chatter storm. My wife and I had just had our first kid, newborn, and you know, I'm for the next 2 or 3 days, I'm pacing the house with a baseball bat up until the early morning hours, thinking to myself, why did I publish a study? Why did I do this? Can I move? Can I protect ourselves? It was really unpleasant. And so I opened the book with that story to foreshadow some tools that can be used, that I actually used to help me get out of that funk, and fortunately never experience it again.
Well, and thank you for sharing that. And one of the things, and you're so right in terms of it's such a valuable read, and it's jam-packed full of tools. And I love the evidence base behind it. You cite so many fantastic studies that you've either been a part of or colleagues have been a part of. And I think what it does is really shine a light on that inner voice. And I love the subtitle, The Voice in Our Head, Why It Matters and How to Harness It. So I'm really excited about digging into that. And when you open the book, you talk about some of the misconceptions that we can have about that, our inner voice, that inner dialogue. And in particular, you talk about introspection, and then you also talk about living in the present. So can you share a little bit more around that? Because I just right away, I was like, okay, this is awesome and really poignant.
Yeah, well, then, you know, so everything I talk about in the book is science-based. That's very important to me as a scientist. And, you know, my feeling about science when it comes to our inner worlds, we haven't figured out everything, but we have figured out a fair amount. And I think science gives us the best chance of being successful in managing our mind more effectively. So readers have that assurance that it is all backed up. One of the things I try to do is correct the record when I see ideas that are promulgated in our culture that aren't grounded in fact, and sometimes are actually wrong. And one of those is this notion that we ought to strive to always be in the moment. This is a pervasive idea that we hear a lot about right now, like got to be in the moment. I have so many students when I teach them that this is all they have heard since they're a little kid. Like if they're not in the moment, there's something wrong with them. How can I be in the now? To be clear, being in the now can be a very useful tool. When we find ourselves trapped in ruminations about the past or worries about the future, it can be useful to redirect our focus onto the present. There are lots of other things you can do as well, but that is an empirically supported tool. However, we are not designed as human beings. We did not evolve to always be in the moment. There are animals that do function always in the moment. They are much, much lower down on the kind of evolutionary scale, the scale, right? Like we're talking about cockroaches, insects. They're navigating the world, as far as we know, just kind of, you know, stimulus response, food, safety, one moment to the next. Think about the glory that comes to us, the joy, the successes that are rooted in not being in the moment. I'll give you a quiz. Like, you, why don't you ask, like, tell me, Craig, like, how do you benefit from thinking about the past? Are there ways?
I would say learning lessons in terms of reflecting
learning
on
lessons, right? That's right. You can't learn lessons unless you focus on the past. How about when did you take your last vacation?
Fortunately, it was last month.
Okay. And where were you?
Dominican.
Oh, Punta Cana, around there?
There you go. I mean, it may have been, yeah, exactly. That's, yep.
That's it. Okay. You ever think about your vacation since you got back?
For sure. Yes.
Well, how does it make you feel when you do?
Amazing. Right. Lots of fabulous memories.
This is called savoring, and it is a key feature of our emotional lives. Like, one of the ways that I put myself to bed is I do one of two things. I savor the past. I'm thinking about what happened earlier that day or an experience I had previously, or I'm eagerly anticipating the future. I'm thinking about the next vacation I have, or this fun, exciting thing at work, or this conversation I'm going over those things. That brings me much joy, right? Just emotionally, it improves the emotional element of my life, my well-being. And as you said before, you could focus on the past to learn things. We also readily focus on the future to simulate and plan. How can I possibly solve problems and be effective if I'm not trying to game out situations, if I'm not trying to prepare? Well, how's the audience going to receive this? Or if I'm writing, how is someone else who reads this going to evaluate what I'm saying? What am I missing? So mental time travel is actually a key feature of the human mind. You don't always want to be in the now. It can be useful at times, but so can be going in the past and future. You want to be flexible. The other comment you have is about introspection. The fun thing about introspection is that we spend actually a great deal of time like floating away and thinking about those other parts of our lives. By some estimates, we spend about 2/3 of our time not focused on the present. So there's a lot of time that we spend away from the moment. As long as you're not doing it in chatter, there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, no, and thank you. One of the things I have to share, because that's my passion, and is why the subtitle of my first book, The Science and Practice of Positive Leadership. And that's why, for people who follow the podcast, know that's a preeminent focus, is what's evidence-based insights, because it's so awesome you shared that. I want to restate that, Ethan, where science gives us the best chances. It maximizes the chances of making an informed choice, and both in our personal and professional lives. And I love one of the things that really took out of the book, and you just do just a fantastic job in, is getting us to approach things in a more nuanced way. Like, rather than the categorical, okay, live in the now, and then that's it. It's just yes, no. Yes, yes. You're saying, well, let's be a little more, and I love the connection to the chatter, let's be more mindful of how we're harnessing our attention, how we're harnessing our mindset. I love that. I've got a question already, which I'm not surprised.
Okay.
Tara was wondering, is there any connection between chatter and dreams?
Oh, that's a great question, Tara. And it's actually a question that my editor asked me after reading the first draft of the book. So there's a little section on this. The quick disclaimer is that there's a lot more we don't know about dreams than we do. They're incredibly difficult to study with rigor. What I learned about dreams, though, while researching the book, is oftentimes there are some theories which suggest that one of the functions of dreams is that it provides us with a kind of safe space to simulate how we're going to respond to different problems we might encounter. This is called the threat simulation hypothesis. And so people will often like game out in their minds, like, huh, well, what if I haven't studied for an exam? Like, you show up and you kind of haven't studied. What happens next? That's one way that chatter can manifest in our dreams, right? Our anxieties, or as we're almost trying to problem solve and work through them by putting ourselves in these situations. There is one caveat here. The way our dreams work, they don't like abide by the rules of physics and reality. And so sometimes like what happens in our dreams is out of sync just a little bit from what happens in daily life, but enough to actually blow our minds and make us like, oh my God, how the hell did I think about that? Like, you know, lots of people show up naked at work, or their teeth are falling out and they're anxious and things like that. And so there's some common themes there, but we do see that kind of chatter expressing itself in our dreams with some regularity.
Interesting though, and lots of comments, great answer, really interesting insights. And I've had multiple questions around this, probably not surprisingly. I'll pick out one from Alan, who says, how about all the chatter that happens in social media? What are your thoughts around that and any tips for how to engage in that most effectively?
Oh, I have a lot of thoughts about that. And Craig, you might have noticed I just looked away here because this wasn't by design, but I've been experiencing a little chatter over the past 3 minutes. I don't know if it's noticeable to you or listeners, but I'll clue you in as I've been dealing with this on the fly. I noticed just a few minutes ago that my battery light on my laptop was very low. And then I reached for my power cord and noticed that it was not in my briefcase. So I've got my backup computer that is now loaded up and I'm going to log in a moment on that. I hope that's okay. Is that fine? Okay.
Yeah,
but did I deal with the chatter okay?
Yeah.
It hasn't been noticed, right? Social media, it provides us with a new environment to engage with. And I like to tell people at the outset that environments aren't good or bad. It's how we engage with those environments that determine the impact they have on us. And we often lose sight of that when we log into the media nowadays, where you hear social media is de facto ruining life, toxic, terrible, terrible, terrible. It is not that simple. On the one hand, social media can make our chatter worse. And we've learned a few bits of information about how that functions. So on the one hand, people possess the ability to curate how they present themselves online. And we are always curating how we present ourselves to others. I wore a jacket today. I have a meeting with you and some other meetings I had to change out of my workout gear from this morning. It would not have been good had I worn that to work. I'm making conscious decisions about the impressions I want to make. In the offline world, the real world in which we live, there are limitations to our ability to curate our appearances, right? Like I actually nicked my face today when I was shaving, nothing I could do about it. That's very different on social media, as everyone knows, right? We can Photoshop our pictures and carefully curate our tweets. Are they still called tweets, by the way? I'm not actually sure. Whatever they are. And what ends up happening then is when we log into these networks, we're just exposed to this highlight reel of other people's lives. And if you do that over and over, it can make you feel bad. So that's one way that social media can undermine chatter. The other thing that it can do is social media makes it easy for us to express emotions, negative emotions that we might not otherwise express to folks. So when I'm talking to someone directly or via Zoom, I'm getting all sorts of information from them, from their face, from their voice about how what I'm saying is impacting them. We don't have any of that. Those empathy cues are totally missing when we're engaged in a social media exchange. It makes it a lot easier for us to just express in an unfiltered fashion the thoughts and feelings streaming through our mind. That can cause more chatter for us, like when we say things that we regret, but it can also contribute to collective chatter because you're spewing out the hate and other people are jumping on the bandwagon and then you get stuck in those kind of negative loops. So those are two ways that social media can make chatter worse. On the flip side, it provides us with an unbelievable resource for getting support. Social media broadens our access to people who can help us and the speed with which they can do so as well, right? If I'm not on social media, I've got to wait to find someone to talk to about what I'm dealing with. If I've got a great network on social media, I can log in right away and odds are I'm going to get a response pretty quick. So to go back to your other comment, Craig, about nuance, human beings are nuanced. We often want simple solutions. Social media is good or bad. Be in the moment or be in the future. do this, don't do that. Avoidance is toxic, approach is good. That is not how we work. And if I think you take a step to reflect on your own mental life, that becomes very, very clear really fast. And so I think the challenge for all of us is to embrace that nuance. And I think once we start doing that, we're going to start finding solutions to our problems a lot quicker than trying to jam these one-size solutions into our lives, which inevitably don't work.
Absolutely. No, and thank you. And I love that point about it being a tool. And it's just such, it resonates so deeply with me. And then we have a choice around how we're going to utilize that tool.
That's right.
And back to that nuance piece, it's that, well, how are we going, under what conditions can it enrich our lives? Under what conditions can it create some challenges? And I had such a great question, and I felt the same way. So I'm glad it's being asked by the audience. And so want to acknowledge that. So Rhonda said, I love, Ethan, that you acknowledged your in-the-moment chatter about your computer. Can you share some ideas about how to be better able to do that? I think it's really hard to do that in real time in front of others. So, and I thought the same. I thought it was masterful. So a great real life example of chatter. So
I appreciate the support. Yeah, it's not fun. Now, part of this is just experiential, but actually we could break it down even further. So one key principle that explains what drives chatter as well as what muffles it is whether we're zooming in or out. When we experience chatter, we tend to zoom in on it. We think about the source of that problem and what we are going through. And that tends to perpetuate these chatter cycles because we're thinking about the awfulness of the situation. Oh my God, live podcast. Craig's been waiting for ages for this to happen. I feel terrible. Where's my laptop? Where's my charger? How could I have forgotten it? But, you know, and blah, 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 blah. And then I'm not listening to you because I'm in my head. And I'm getting more aroused. Bad things are going to happen. Performance is going to suffer. My blood pressure is raising. That's zooming in. And I want to be clear, we often do that reflexively for a very good reason. People often ask, if chatter is so harmful, why do we keep doing it? Well, the reason we keep doing it is throughout our lives, what are we taught? Hey, when you have a problem, focus on it. Try to work through and solve that problem. Like, this is a strategy that is hammered home and reinforced from the time we're little kids, right? Think about the math problem. Try to work out the kind of the essay critical thinking. And it's an approach to solving problems that serves us well. Like, this is not a scientific estimate. It's anecdotal. I don't know, 99% of the time. 99% of the time, zooming in on a problem helps us solve it, except when that problem is flooded with emotion. That's when this normal approach doesn't work optimally. And so what do you do then? Well, one strategy is to zoom out, to look at that bigger picture. Solutions to our problems are often found when we zoom out and look at that bigger picture. So what was I doing in the moment when I discovered the laptop was about to like implode just now? One thing I reminded myself was, Ethan, you've been in this situation many times before. And this is true because tech is my Achilles heel, right? So I've literally had a laptop blow up on me in a live presentation. I managed it. I've had the mic fail in front of thousands of people on Zoom sessions. I've managed it. And so instantly by zooming out, that's changing how I'm appraising this situation rather than viewing this as a threat. Oh my God, what am I going to do? Instead, the thought process was, you'll deal with this, not a big deal. So automatically I'm approaching it from a place of calm. Then I can start problem solving. Hey, I got a computer behind me. I can access the site. So in that instance, just to summarize, I use distance self-talk. We haven't talked about that tool yet, but it's probably the first thing I do. It's my favorite zooming out tool. I use my name and a second person pronoun, you, to try to coach myself through a situation. Might seem weird why any human being would do that. We often make fun of people who do that. But in fact, what we know about human beings is we are much better at giving advice to other people than we are to ourselves. Like, think about the last time a friend came to you with a problem. Not happening to you, you can give them sound advice. When the same thing's happening to you, we often really struggle. What distant self-talk does is it capitalizes on this feature of the human condition. When you use your name or a word like you to refer to yourself, it basically turns on the mental machinery for giving advice to others. And that makes it much easier for us to wisely and calmly navigate stressful situations. So I did that. And then I reframed my experience as a challenge. I can do it rather than a threat. I can't do it. That's what helped me there.
And I've got so many comments. I won't even be able to get through them all. Awesome. Love this insight. And then this is fantastic. So Michael, thank you for this. One of my favorite webinar episodes I've been a part of, just seeing this in real time makes it so authentic. Thank you, Ethan. It's fantastic insight. And I love how you're talking about that zooming out and having that different perspective and how we can walk ourselves through that process. I think it's just so valuable. Got more questions coming in. So I have one from Dave saying, checking out the wonderful toolbox. A suggestion is to perform a ritual with others. This infers some group or sociological significance. So what group activities today may help ease individual chatter?
So rituals, as was just mentioned, can be really effective for managing chatter. Rituals are often done in group contexts, and that's part of what can make them powerful. So let me first define a ritual for you and then go over a few things about what we know with respect to how they work. So when I use the term ritual, or when scientists use that term, what we're talking about are rigid sequences of behaviors that are infused with meaning. And they're sequences of behaviors that don't necessarily correspond to the broader context in which they're engaged. That sounds really abstract. Let me be super clear. So take a religious ritual. You know, in certain religious traditions, when someone dies, you, like, let's say in Hinduism, when someone dies, you often dress in white and surround yourself with colorful things, and you shave your head if you're a man. In Judaism, you actually do the exact opposite. You dress in black and you let your hair grow, right? So same, you're engaging in these acts for the same broader reason, to like grieve the loss of someone, but you're doing the totally different things. What you do during a ritual doesn't really matter. It's how you do it and why you do it. So a ritual is something that is under your control. You can perform a ritual the same way every single time. That's really important because when we're experiencing chatter, we often feel like we don't have control. We're not in control of what's happening to us. And we don't like that because human beings are control freaks. We all like to know that the world is predictable and orderly and that we can exert some effect on the world around us. What we've learned is that when you don't feel like you're in control of things, you can compensate for that feeling out of control by exerting control around you. And that's what a ritual, that's one way that it can help us. It gives you the sense of agency. So think about athletes, for example, who are often asked to do things in situations where they're not in control of what's going to happen, right? Like they don't have control of the audience in a loud stadium, and it can be really frustrating, but they can control how many times they bounce the ball and spin it on the free throw line before shooting. So that's one way that rituals help. But when a ritual is performed with other people, it like boosts its value in some way, because now we're also benefiting from social support and social connection and this sense of togetherness, which further provides us with another aid for bringing the volume down on our chatter. So you can think of a ritual as kind of a multi-pronged tool for helping. There's one other point to maybe mention here, Craig, because I think the question was, how do we deal with chatter in groups? Well, was that was the impetus for this?
Yes.
So the one other thing I would mention here is rituals are like one category. The other thing that really comes to mind for helping groups deal with chatter is understanding how to talk about chatter. Because a lot of people think that when you're experiencing chatter, if I'm experiencing it, what I should do is find someone to just get it out, to just express the emotions. Don't keep it bottled up inside. Catharsis, very popular idea. There's been a lot of research on this, and what we've learned is that simply expressing your emotions to someone else, that can be really good for strengthening the friendship and relational bonds between two people. It feels good to know that there's someone who's willing to take the time and listen to me. But if that's all you do in a conversation, you often leave that conversation, you feel really good about the person you just spoke with because, hey, they've got your back. But you're just as upset, if not more upset, when you leave the conversation, because all you've done is gone over
the most emotion provoking elements of the experience. So you're lit up, right? And so if that's not the optimal way to talk about chatter, what is? You want to do two things. First, you do want to take some time at the beginning of the conversation to share what you're going through. It is important to express your emotions. It is important for the person that you're talking to hear, to learn about what you're going through. But then at a certain point in the conversation, ideally the conversation begins to shift. The person you're speaking with begins to prompt you to look at that bigger picture, and they start working with you to try to help you work through the problem. And they're in an ideal position to help you do that because the problem's not happening to them. So, you know, they could do things like ask you, hey, Craig, how do you think you should deal with it? Or have you dealt with instances like that in the future? What would you tell me if I was going through this? Or maybe they share some experiences that they've had dealing with similar kinds of circumstances. That is the kind of blueprint for both getting good chatter support. And if you're on the other side of the equation, providing it to others, the first part is listening and learning. And then the second part is working through and advising. Now, there's an art to doing that well. And what I mean by that is, depending on the person and what they're going through, some people need to spend a little bit more time just expressing their feelings before they're ready to transition into that working through phase. And so my advice to folks is sometimes it'll be clear when to transition. And if it is, go for it. But if it's not, you can ask people. And I'll do this all the time with friends and my wife. You know, they start going and, hey, can I talk to you about stuff? Of course, what's going on? I listen, I learn, I nod attentively and genuinely. And then when I see my opening, I totally got it. I have a thought. Can I share it? You want to keep going? Sometimes the other person says, no, I'm not yet done. Let me keep on going a little more. Okay. And at other times they're like, yes, please tell me. What do you think? That's why I'm here. I need your... So that's a kind of a little playbook for managing those conversations.
Well, and I love that. Again, so many comments coming in. Like, this is so rich. Thank you. Really interesting, very nuanced. So that comment that was made. And I love the point that you're making as well about that listening piece at the front end and then gathering, learning, observing, all of those things. I love that you're talking about, Ethan, as well, checking in and then pivoting to the, and you touched on this earlier, which I think is such an important, valuable skill. And you talk about it throughout, that reframing piece, the asking the questions, working through it with people. So many questions continuing to come in. And one, it's funny, how timing wise, just perfectly relates to the last question and perhaps can build on it. So Renee was wondering, how do you determine when it's appropriate what chatter to share in an effort to connect or lead people, or choose which chatter to keep to yourself?
Great question. So if you're asking me personally, that's probably the best position to answer this question, because I don't know of a study that is perfectly does so, but we can draw from the literature. I like to divide the world into several buckets of tools for managing chatter. There are tools you can use on your own. We talked about a couple thus far, like distant self-talk. There's some with rituals, there are plenty of others. Then there are people tools, ways of interacting with other people that can help us or harm us when it comes to our chatter. We just talked about one of those. And then there are also environmental tools, ways of interacting with physical spaces that can be helpful. My first line of defense is almost always the personal tools. Those are things that I can do in the moment, on the fly. I don't need permission to do them. I can do them quickly, often. And I don't know, maybe 2/3 of the time, those are all I need to do to get that chatter in check. Sometimes, however, if the chatter is a little bit more intense, or it's later at night when maybe I'm not as fresh as I am earlier in the day, I'll need a little bit more support to work through that chatter. And that's when I go into the people bucket. I don't do that haphazardly, though. I have an unbelievable board of chatter advisors. And what I mean by that is I have people who I know are adept at not just listening, but listening and also advising and doing it in that order. There may be 4 or 5 people who do that for me with personal stuff and 5 or 6 for professional stuff. And they are an invaluable resource for helping me manage my chatter. Now, I don't abuse that board. If I were going to that board every single day, multiple times a day, they would probably begin to pull away a little bit. So I am somewhat, I don't feel inhibited in calling those folks up for help when I need it.
but I'm not also doing it all the time because I don't need to. So my advice here is you want to identify, it's almost like when the United States is, maybe this is the wrong analogy here, but we'll run with it. We'll see. Like if there's an invasion, there's multi layers, like different kinds of interventions, level one, level DEFCON 1, 2, 3, right? And so the first line of defense is to roll out some of those individual tools. If that's not enough, I ratchet it up a little bit more.
And again, so many comments coming in. Thank you. Love these insights. So valuable. Another question that is just stacks of questions coming in. Cool. Allison was wondering, really was interesting how you talked about the environment. And I'm curious about how our environment affects us. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
I mean, one of the real aha moments for me when researching the book was looking at some of the ways that our physical spaces can impact what happens between our ears. And once I learned about this research, it's almost as though like I was blind to resources that existed all around me. And now that I know where they are, I regularly avail myself of that. So what are those resources? So one is creating order around you. This was actually a moment of self-insight for me because as I've mentioned several times before, I consider myself to be a very clean and hygienic individual. I shower daily, multiple soaps, all that good stuff. But in terms of orderliness, most of the time you come into my office, there's stacks of books and papers all over the place and clothing on the floor to my wife's dismay in our bedroom. But when I have chatter, and I've done this since I was little, I will reflexively start putting things away and creating piles and making things nice and neat. And I do that to this day, right? I will tidy up my office and then go into the kitchen and make sure all the pots are clean. And then sometimes if the chatter is really bad, I'll even masochistically go into my kids' bedrooms and clean up their spaces. Crazy, right? Why would someone do this? Well, it turns out there's a rationale for this. And this is something that many people resonate with. When you don't have control of what's happening inside your mind, you can compensate for that experience by creating order around you. So that's one way that your space can impact you. Another way is by enhancing your exposure to green spaces, natural spaces. And there are a couple of ways that that can help. One thing that enhancing your exposure to green spaces do is it is a restorative experience. So chatter can be attentionally demanding, right? Because you're spending all this energy focusing on this problem, trying to work through it, but you're not making any progress. And there's a catch 22 there because the act of experiencing chatter drains you of the resources that you often need to manage your chatter. And what research shows happens when you go for a walk in a green space is your attention very gently drifts and is captured by your interesting surroundings. What do I mean by that? Well, when you're walking through a park or a tree-lined street, you just kind of begin to take in the trees and the grass and the snow. And you're not doing so in a very focused way. It's not like you're carefully scrutinizing the geometrical structure of the leaves, right? You're just taking it in, and that gives you an opportunity to restore your attention, which can be very helpful. The other thing that nature does is it gives us repeated opportunities to experience the emotion of awe, which is an emotion we experience when we're in the presence of something vast and indescribable, like an amazing sunset or a tree that's been alive for hundreds of years. You can also experience awe from humanity's innovation. One of my awe triggers are spaceships. I still, when I tell myself or someone else that we have an SUV currently roaming on Mars that's giving us footage of what the terrain looks like, part of me feels like I'm making something up, but I'm not, because it's actually happened. We have somehow figured out how to create these machines that blast into outer space and I'm probably making clear that I was never really good in physics, but I still don't quite understand how we fly or how we figured out how to create a car, but we have. And it fills me with awe when I contemplate those sources of innovation. Here's what happens to your chatter when you experience that emotion of awe. Awe leads to something that we call a shrinking of the self. So you feel smaller when you're contemplating something vast and indescribable. And when you feel smaller, so does your chatter. So awe has a way of really putting our experiences in perspective quite powerfully.
So those are a couple of ways that you can harness your environment to your own betterment, freely available, side effect free. And I would encourage folks who are listening to incorporate them into their toolbox.
Well, and this is great. And I have to read this comment from Keith, who says, that's amazing. I'm going for a walk after this.
Exactly.
There you go. And in all seriousness, and there was a smiley face. So that's great. And to your point, which I think is so valuable as you go through the book, which I love. And as you say, you approach it in different categories. And what I find is so thought-provoking and inspiring is that, as you just shared, Ethan, these things are right in front of us. They are free, they're readily accessible. And yet those subtle changes that we can miss, once again, can have profound impacts and shift our perspective. And I think that's so valuable, because in a world where we're just go, 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 and caught up in that pace, that relentless pace, it's recognizing, okay, I have choice, I have opportunities. There's support all around me, within myself, with others, and within my environment. I think that's so, so powerful.
What both fills me with hope on most days, but sometimes I get discouraged about, is the hope, the message of hope is that we have the solutions already inside us. It's really about figuring out how to activate them and when to activate them. Where I sometimes get discouraged, but I use this as motivation, is why aren't we teaching this stuff to people more? Like, some of this science is new. Some of it's older. We've known about it for a while. We have amassed a really interesting and informative and useful body of knowledge here. But my kids, you know, they still don't have a course on how to manage their inner voice, right? They do get some mindfulness and yoga at school, and those are great skills, but they're 2 out of 30 things that we know that can be really helpful. We spend a ton of time teaching kids about geometry and algebra and digestive systems and integrals. I mean, these can be very important topics. It's not zero sum. We don't have to, you know, say what's more important than others, but I haven't had occasion to use my knowledge of the digestive system or integrals or geometry very much over the past 2 decades. I am called upon my knowledge of how to manage my emotions and how to manage other people's emotions and how to help other people manage their emotions. That is knowledge that I draw upon every single day, multiple times a day. So why aren't we doing a better job of teaching and communicating this stuff to people at all points in their life, from the time they're little kids to if they haven't had this information to when they're at the older endpoints of life? I think there's just a tremendous opportunity to do that. And I think it would benefit society if we did.
I'm with you 1,000%. And it's interesting. So through my journey in grad school, continuing into my professional year when I was pursuing my PhD, I was like, this is awesome. There's so much interesting research that's done and being done and continues to evolve. And it shines a light on a path forward for, once again, how we can maximize our chances to have a successful career, a successful relationship, a successful life, like however you want to frame that. And I just think it's so exciting. And I love that you mentioned that, because for me, that's why I love having conversations like this. This is not just the right thing to do. These aren't just powerful techniques. They are embedded in scientific research and insight, and we continue to grow our knowledge in that space.
Yeah, I've got.
Thank you. I've got one. Time is flying by. We're almost at the end, so this is great. And it's interesting you were talking about, you know, kind of older practice. This is one of those. So a question comes in from Sherry saying, one of my mentors has highlighted the power of having a harsh inner critic driving our success. So what are your thoughts around that in terms of where this comes from, or how valid is that perspective?
Thank you for that comment. And I think it's a really important one. We often are very quick to vilify a tough inner voice. You know, it's kind of like not being in the now. It's always bad. Not true. Sometimes being harsh and tough with yourself can be very useful. Yes, having self-acceptance can be nice, but sometimes, like, you screwed this up. You better fix this now. And the point that this touches upon is that in our society, we often vilify negative emotions. I have some books behind me somewhere. One of them is called, like, Toxic Emotions, Anger,
depression and anxiety. All emotions, when experienced in the right proportions, not too big and not too long, are tools. They are useful. Anxiety. I have a big engagement coming up next week. I experienced a little bit of anxiety today about it. You know what that's doing for me? It's motivating me after this podcast. I'm going to work on that presentation. Okay. Anger. Anger is an emotion we experience when we perceive a transgression that we believe we can still correct, right? So if I see my daughter do something really dangerous, you know, riding a bicycle without a helmet or playing with a knife up in the kitchen, I can express anger as a means. It's a signal to correct that behavior so it doesn't happen again. So negative emotions in the right dosages, you don't want to live life without that capacity. What you don't want to have happen is to have the experience too intensely or for too long. That's a different situation. But this relates to that inner drill sergeant, because sometimes being tough with ourselves can actually be useful. Chronically accepting everything that happens in life can make us feel better, but isn't always good for us long term. And I think that's an important point to embrace as well.
Well, and again, so many comments coming in, and great question, and love the answer. And this comment in particular saying, really appreciate the balanced perspective, Ethan, that you're bringing to these complex topics. Very important. And I'm glad you highlighted the limitations of endless positivity. I've wondered about that myself. So this is great. And we're essentially at that time. I knew this one. It was almost when the floodgates opened with the questions, they kept coming. And this has been such a rich conversation. I'm curious, what is it that, you know, when you look at the future and you were talking about the things that we've learned and where we're going, what are some of the key areas that you're really excited about exploring and you think there's more coming down the pipeline for us as we better understand our own chatter?
Well, one of the things that I think scientists have done a really good job at doing is profiling how individual tools work. And I talk about that work in my book, like different tools. Here's how we learned about them. Here's how they manifest in life. Here's how you can use them. What we haven't done as good of a job doing, though, is studying how do those tools work together when you use them simultaneously. And we know from recent work that most of the time that people try to manage their chatter or their emotions more broadly, they're often using more than one tool at a time. And so one of the things that we've started doing now is looking at those strategy combinations to see, hey, what are the pairings? Is it doing two or three different reframing change the way you think about your circumstances? Is that the optimal route for an individual? Or is it putting together a much more diverse set of tools? Maybe it's a little bit of distancing, a little bit of exercising in nature with a little bit of music listening to. And so we're beginning to try to understand what those combinations of tools are. And additionally, we're trying to come up with new technologies to help people identify the combinations of tools that work best for them. I think that's where a lot of this work is going. And it's really exciting to be a part of.
And it makes so much sense in terms of, as you say, a lot of times we look at singular interventions or singular practices and then how they apply, which is valuable. I love how you're saying, okay, let's look at the combination or perhaps the sequencing of the combination. And back to one of the themes we discussed earlier, which is that nuanced perspective to really deepen our understanding. And that's what I love, I have to say, because there are different books written or different articles written around our inner voice. And it's something that I have to say that really sets chatter apart to me is that it looks at it almost in a 360 way, such that at the end, you feel like you're able to step into the balcony and go, ah, this is so interesting. I appreciate that inner voice in so many different ways in where I can have more insight. Again, how I can harness it most effectively without just using it as a bludgeoning tool. So this has been awesome. So, so happy. As I said, I've got so many positive comments. So thank you. Any final thoughts, Ethan, before we close our conversation today?
Just thanking the audience for being so engaged and participatory. It makes it so much more fun for a guest to be in conversation with a group. So really, really appreciate you all bringing your attention with you today. Wishing you all chatter-free days ahead.
That's awesome. Well, and thank you. This is just, I've been, as I said, looking forward to this. so much since we got it on our calendar. And for those of you in the live audience, because I know, and thank you, as Ethan shared, your questions and enthusiasm can just make the richness of this experience fantastic. I feel so privileged. So Ethan, thank you again so much for your time, your energy, your experience, and doing a live chatter test right in front of us. So it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Craig. Look forward to the next time.
See ya. Hey, everybody. Bye for now.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.